Hi, writers. Welcome to our new episode about the art and craft of writing fiction. This is Jim Thayer. Let's talk about clothes, the things we wear every day, and the items our characters wear. Specifically, how to show with clothes, how to give evidence to reveal a character to the reader with his or her clothing. Fashion is my life, as you may have inferred. But let's dig deeper. Clothing on a character, the way we dress our characters, can do a lot for us writers. All characters should be described shortly after the reader first sees them, which is important because characters who are not described or described poorly have difficulty engaging the reader. They remain a vague smear in the reader's mind, and that's why it's important to describe them soon after the reader meets them. But here's another angle, and it's about clothing. A character's clothing can reveal, that is to show rather than tell, a lot about a character. I'd like to mention clothing that shows about a character. That's more subtle maybe than the low-cut blouse or on a female character or jeans that shows the plumber's crack on a male character. Clothing on our characters can send lots of revealing signals to the reader. Here are some examples. Yes, many of them are stereotypes, but fiction has a lot of stereotypes that work. A character who wears a bow tie. The reader is going to think that character is prim and traditional and wants to be looked at. That's why men wear bow ties. How about a pen in a shirt pocket? That character is busy with small things and is detail-oriented. If we have a character who has patches on a jacket's elbow, maybe that character is an academic. Patches on a jacket elbow is classic college academic lounge dress. How about a leather skirt or leather pants on a female character? These are suggestive of fun and that she goes to clubs she'd be fun to hang out with. A shirt that's not tucked in. These days not so much, but it can indicate a character's a slob, especially if only half the shirt is tucked in. How about someone who wears a belt and suspenders? Ever seen that? This fellow is overly cautious. It's become a snappy phrase. He's a belt and suspenders guy. That means he's real careful. Someone who wears a bathrobe in the middle of the day, you're going to reveal that person's probably a slob. Scuffed shoes, that character's having a tough time in life. Fashion people know that a man's socks should most closely match the color of his pants, not his shoes. Did you know that? I had to ask my daughter. So a character wearing socks the color of his shoes rather than the color of his pants would be someone who isn't fashionable. A lot of readers would infer that. A character whose coat is buttoned tightly all the way up is reserved and shy. It's a stereotype, but sometimes stereotypes work in fiction. A woman wearing a sundress is a fun person. A sundress, of course, is a lightweight, often sleeveless dress. It's often brightly colored. Sometimes they're worn on the first nice day of spring, and what a tonic after a cold gray winter. I was in Amsterdam a couple summers ago. Amsterdam on a sunny day is filled with lovely young ladies wearing sundresses and riding bicycles. At intersections, there'd be a stream of them, their dresses ruffling in the slipstream as they pedaled by it. It's my main memory of that wonderful city, and that includes seeing Rembrandt's Night Watch at the Rijksmuseum. My wife, Patty, had to push me along the Amsterdam sidewalk, telling me to focus on our destination. I'm painting with a broad brush here. Still, sundresses mean a person is fun, especially when worn by someone on a bicycle. When Eisenhower was president, men wore hats. President Kennedy killed the dress hat industry. Today, a young man wearing a fedora wants people to look at him. He needs attention. Same with someone wearing a pork pie hat, the kind of hat that Popeye Doyle, played by Gene Hackman, wore in the movie The French Connection. That's called a pork pie hat. A female character wearing a broad-brimmed sun hat is outgoing and fun. Sure, it's a stereotype, but stereotypes can convey a lot in fiction. A female character who wears a blazer will be judged by readers to be competent and a no-nonsense person. A young lady wearing stiletto high heels will be viewed by readers as being more out there, more daring. A male character wearing a scarf thinks about fashion, thinks about presenting himself, and doesn't object to looking at himself in a mirror. It means he might be vain. Yeah, that's another stereotype, but readers know that most men don't wear scarves. It's one notch on the fashion dial less than an ascot. A male in fiction wearing a scarf is sending a message about himself, same as in real life. There are many more items of clothing and how those items are worn that can reveal something about a character in our story. Everything in a story should contribute, and that includes clothing. Here's a strong technique. When we are writing and adding an item of clothing to a character we're describing, ask ourselves, what signal can this item send to the reader? What will it reveal to the reader about our character? Can this item do double duty, which is to say, first, prevent our character from being naked, we're going to put clothing on him, and second, showing, as opposed to telling, something about the character to the reader? I received a nice email from Audra in response to my question, how did you find your path to writing? Audra wrote, I started writing as a child. I was, am, a huge animal lover, and as soon as I could read, I started discovering every novel on animals, both wild and domestic, I could get my hands on. By the time I was 11, I was reading Call of the Wild. By 12, I started writing my own stories. My best friend and I would write down story ideas on scraps of paper, mix them up in a box, pick some out, and then write short stories based on those plots. When I was 13, I wrote and illustrated my own, quote, novel about a wild horse. It was handwritten on notebook paper, and I also illustrated it. My dad worked for AT&T, and he gave me a blue three-ring binder with the AT&T logo on it that I used as the cover for my book. I taped a photo of myself on the cover along with my byline. I still have it. Isn't that a nice story from Audra? If you'd like to tell me how you found your path to writing, I'd like to read it. You can send it to me at jimthayerseattle@gmail.com. Here is, from Mason Curry's book Daily Rituals, how Patricia Highsmith works. She wrote the psychological thrillers Strangers on a Train and The Talented Mr. Ripley and four other novels featuring Mr. Ripley. Mason Curry says Highsmith was, quote, as solitary and misanthropic as some of her heroes. Writing was less a source of pleasure for her than a compulsion without which she was miserable. And this is Patricia Highsmith, there is no real life except in working, that is to say, in the imagination. Fortunately, Highsmith was rarely short of inspiration. She had a lot of ideas. This is Mason Curry. Highsmith wrote daily, usually for 3 or 4 hours in the morning, completing 2,000 words on a good day. The biographer Andrew Wilson records her methods. Her favorite technique to ease herself into the right frame of mind for work was to sit on her bed surrounded by cigarettes, ashtray, matches, a mug of coffee, a donut, and an accompanying saucer of sugar. She had to avoid any sense of discipline and make the act of writing as pleasurable as possible. Her position, Highsmith noted, would be almost fetal, and, indeed, her intention was to create, she said, quote, a womb of her own, end quote. That's Mason Curry on how Patricia Highsmith worked. I like knowing that. Maybe some of it will rub off on me. I hope you are finding these podcasts useful, and if you are, please consider a Patreon subscription. Below the episode description is a link that says support the show. If you'll hit on it, it'll take you to a Patreon page, and your subscription will be greatly appreciated. I would like to mention chapter length and chapter construction. I've said in earlier episodes that the best book on writing fiction I've ever come across is Scene and Structure by the novelist and writing teacher Jack Bickham, who wrote 75 published novels and was a professor at the University of Oklahoma. In the book, Scene and Structure, he sets out a question that he's often asked at writing conferences. How long should a chapter be? And Bickham writes in his book, Scene and Structure, this is Jack Bickham, there is no single answer to this unless you happen to be writing for a publisher whose tip sheet or editorial policy stipulates a standard chapter length. A few romance publishers do. Otherwise, the best answer one might give is somewhere between 10 and 30 manuscript pages, probably leaning toward the shorter end of the spectrum, but don't hold me to have a clear answer. That's Jack Bickham, and he continues, clearly, unless your publisher has specified a desired length for his company's chapters, the length of the chapter is what you make it. There simply is no ideal model length for a chapter. The very division of novels into chapters is a wholly artificial convention that owes its existence in part to the needs of British publishers in the earliest days of the form. They published their stories in serials, like tabloid newspapers that came out once a week, so there had to be some kind of a breaking off point every so often to signal an end to this week's installment and hook the reader into buying next week's edition. Still, you're writing a novel, and you need some straight answers here. Much of what follows may not seem very straight to you, but the overriding principle can be made clearly enough. Jack Bickham continues, the greatest danger to success of your story is that the reader will put it down during the reading and then not pick it up again. Where is the best place to put a book down? At the end of a chapter. Therefore, the guiding philosophy about chapter construction must be this. Regardless of how long or short your chapters may be, always end them at a point where the reader can't put the book down. Jack Bickham says, you should try to have some general norm for chapter length in any given manuscript, an average chapter being 14 typewritten pages, for example. But if dramaturgy suggests a chapter of only one page here and there as the best way to keep your reader hooked, don't be afraid to do it. The best place to end a chapter is at the moment of a disaster ending a scene. Bickham goes on, the reader will turn the page eagerly to see what happens next, which makes the disaster the strongest reader motivator there is. So you contrive your chapter plans so that a good disaster falls somewhere around the page number that you want, arbitrarily, to end the chapter. The reader can't quit there. He has to start the next chapter to see what happens next. Let me pull back from Jack Bickham a minute and add a thought. I don't think Bickham, when he speaks of a disaster to end a chapter, is always talking about a physical disaster, such as a train wreck or a bridge collapse or a bullet being fired or slipping and falling on ice on the sidewalk. These work sometimes, but what he is also speaking about is the protagonist failing to reach her goal of that chapter. She's told no by someone or something. She learns she can't have what she's been trying to get in that chapter, and that's the disaster. It might be something like the school principal telling her, "No, I can't overlook Marianne's failing grades. She must be held back a year." That's a disaster. It's not a train wreck, but it's a disaster. Here's more from Jack Bickham. The next best place to end a chapter is right in the middle of the conflict. The goal is set. The fight starts. The reader is positively salivating with excitement, and you break the chapter. Your reader is mildly shocked by this break in the conflict and turns the page where he sees a new chapter heading, and the conflict continuing immediately as if there had been no chapter break. Your reader can't quit under these circumstances. Let me stop Jack Bickham again here to mention something. He's of course not always speaking about a physical fight, say a fist fight or a gunfight. It could be an argument, two characters having it out with each other in the middle of which the chapter ends. Bickham goes on, other good places to end chapters are obvious to you. You will lure your reader forward more mildly than you would using one of the breaks mentioned above, but still strongly, if you end a chapter with our character stuck in his thought process of a sequel, thinking there is no way out. In a similar way, you can end the chapter at the decision point or the beginning of a new action. Before the conflict starts, as the character resumes goal orientation and the reader can see what's next and anticipate it with huge delight. Bickham says, if a negative injunction might help, please note this well. You end chapters at places which will hook the reader. You do not devise your chapters to provide convenient blank spaces in between them for purposes of transition. And this is particularly important from Jack Bickham's book, Scene and Structure. This is such a common mistake in new writers that I wish there were a way to give it more emphasis. Time and again, good novels are wrecked by poor chaptering. The author ending a chapter with a character going to sleep, for example, or putting in a chapter ending so that the next chapter can start sometime later, the awkward transition having taken place between chapters. Chapters should always link forward in some way, and ending at nighty-night time or using the space between chapters for author convenience in handling a transition will turn the book into a series of chunky separate chapter units that stop so abruptly they practically scream to the reader, stop here and put the book down. Jack Bickham says, readers want to be lured and hooked and dazzled and fascinated, and scene structure gives you all the weapons you need. End your chapters with the strongest hook you can devise, usually scene-ending disasters, and the length of the chapters will take care of itself. That's Jack Bickham on chapter length and how to end chapters. It's very strong advice. I'd like to talk about coming up with an idea for your next novel, or coming up with ideas for the rest of the current novel, the one you're writing right now. Some of it involves inspiration. Jack London said, "You can't wait for inspiration. You have to go after it with a club." Nancy Kress, K-R-E-S-S, is a good writer, and she's a terrific instructor of writing techniques. This is Nancy Kress. Waiting for a good idea for a novel to settle on you isn't the smartest or most efficient way to come up with an idea for a novel. It allows us to think we're doing something, waiting for inspiration, when in fact we aren't doing anything. A system to invent your next novel would be nice, and here is one. The same system will work when coming up with a missing part of your current novel. This is Nancy Kress, and she's going to tell us how to come up with ideas for our novel or our next novel. She says, Nancy Kress says, do things in a certain order, methodically. 1. First, get a story idea. If you don't have one, sit down with a phone book and start copying names from it, beginning with Aaron Aronson, promising yourself you won't stop until you have a story idea, and you'll have an idea in 3 minutes. That's Nancy Kress. Boy, she write about this. Here she is again. Let's say you want to write a mystery about an attic that drips blood. Good start. We'll build a story around that idea. This is an idea, but it isn't a plot. Everyone has ideas. A plot, though, is something that can be written, polished, and sold. So once we have an idea, we need to build a plot. 2. The next step is to create a main character for the plot. A main character needs 3 attributes. A. A need or want. To find the secret of the lost gold mine, to escape the evil dragon master, to win the heart of his or her true love. Characters who want something are interesting. And the higher you set the stakes, the more interesting their stories will be. B. A strong point. These are Nancy Kress's 3 things a character needs. B. A strong point. Courage, love, generosity, some personality trait that confers on him or her the potential for triumph. C. A flaw. Fear, greed, laziness, gullibility, some trait that, unless overcome, may lead to the character's downfall. Number 3, from Nancy Kress, put our character in a fairly stable situation, then introduce the story problem. The story problem is what the character must solve to get what he or she wants. For instance, if the police think she killed her rich uncle for his money, then I have a problem. She must solve it, establish her innocence to get what she wants, which is to be cleared of suspicion. Number 4 from Nancy Kress. The character will try to solve the problem, but her efforts will only worsen the problem. But our hero won't give up. Instead, through actions and insights that grow from the strong point, she will learn about the fatal flaw. Number 5. With this knowledge, our character will make a final, enormous, story-climbing effort, overcoming the fatal flaw, using the strong point, and triumphing over the story problem. Nancy Kress continues, we have deliberately put these attributes, what's wanted, a strong point, and a fatal flaw, into our main character because we're going to use them to develop the plot. You still need crisp dialogue, vivid description, solid characters, but this plot is what keeps readers reading. It is the solid technical element on which all the other skills must hang. That's Nancy Kress on developing our plot. I've leaned a lot on her and on Jack Bickham for this episode because their advice is so important for us writers. We've arrived at the end of this episode, which is a happy coincidence as I've arrived at the end of my thoughts about writing today. I'll see you next time. This is Jim Thayer in Seattle. Please keep tapping those keys.